For nature.
For the ocean.
For people.
For animals.
Welcome, Sound Expander community. I'm really, really happy that you are here today. And I really have to say, I have such an honor today to have Captain Paul Watson in this podcast today. Thank you. Thank you, Paul, for being here, for taking your time, for sharing your message in this community. Thank you and welcome.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure.
Hey, I know you are always very busy, so it's really a big pleasure for us that you're here and that you share your message. Captain Paul Watson. Paul is the founder of the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, and I listened, of course, to many, many speeches, what you have given already in the last times, and I saw something I really want to share right now. There are three very big values, what you always mention, that is passion, courage, and imagination. And you said once in a talk, the way to change this world to a better one is by passionate people having the courage to act. And this is really, really a big message, I think. And there's a sentence you always repeat, Paul. There's something you really repeat and repeat over and over again. This is really a big sentence. It's a very short one. But you always say, if the ocean dies, we all die. Can you please explain a little bit about that? What does this mean? Because many people in this who are listening to this podcast might not know what the ocean means to us. Can you explain that, please?
Well, the ocean is the life support system of the entire planet. Phytoplankton, the plant life in the ocean, provides up to 70% of the oxygen that we breathe. And since 1950, we've had a 40% decrease in phytoplankton populations in the sea. And most people are completely unaware of that. But the reality is that if phytoplankton goes away, we do too. And if phytoplankton is diminished, we're diminished. We simply cannot live on a planet without phytoplankton. And there are many factors that are contributing to the diminishment of phytoplankton: overfishing, pollution, climate change, all of these things. But I always like to tell people to look at the Earth for what it is. It's a spaceship. Yeah. We're on this incredible voyage around the Milky Way galaxy on this incredibly large and fast spaceship. And every spaceship has a life support system that provides us with the air we breathe and the food we eat and regulates climate and temperature. And that life support system is run and maintained by a crew of Earthlings, sentient creatures that keep everything going, and non-sentient creatures, but a diversity of life that keeps it going. And what we humans, we're not really crew members, we're more passengers having a wonderful time amusing ourselves, but what we're doing is we're murdering crew members, we're killing them off. And there's only so many crew members you can kill before the machinery begins to break down. And so we really have to learn to respect and live in harmony with all of those species that make it possible for us to even be here. Everything from viruses to microbes to algae to phytoplankton to worms to fish to bees. They're all essential for our survival.
That's amazing. And because you just said worms, something is ringing here in my mind, because once I heard you saying about, and this is so true, I just give you, this is so right what you say, that worms are so much more important than people for the planet, right? Can you say why? This is a really good sentence.
Well, years ago, I got a call from a reporter for Fox Network in the US, and Brett Hume's name was there. And he said, I heard that you said that worms and trees and bees are more important than people. I said, yeah, I did say that. He said, well, that's outrageous. How could you say something so outrageous as to say worms are more important than people? I said, well, the reality is that we can live, they can live here without us, but we can't live without them. We need them. They don't need us. Ecologically, they're far more important than we are. We just have to get over our sense of dominance and superiority, and it's all about us, and understand that we need all of these other creatures for our own survival.
Yeah. Yeah, we humans, we sometimes really believe that without us, nothing works, right? In the end, it's the opposite.
Well, many years ago, thousands of years ago, humans developed this outlook, this paradigm, which I call anthropocentrism, as opposed to what indigenous cultures still practice today, which is biocentrism. Biocentrism is the understanding that we're part of everything and that we're connected with everything. Anthropocentrism is this idea that we're better than everything, we're dominant over everything, we're the only species that matters. And it's a form of collective mass psychosis, really. But until we overcome that, we're alienating ourselves more and more from the natural world. And there are three basic laws of ecology. The first law is the law of diversity. The strength of an ecosystem is dependent upon diversity within it. The second, the law of interdependence. So the species within that ecosystem are interdependent with each other. And third, that there's a law of finite resources, that there's a limit to growth and a limit to carrying capacity. And when we steal the carrying capacity from other species, we cause diminishment of both diversity and interdependence, which doesn't bode well for our future.
Yeah, totally. Hey, Paul, when you started to become an activist, it's quite long ago. You are an activist since a long time already. I mean, you're really, fighting for this world since so long. This is amazing. Thank you for that. What was your biggest reason or the biggest thing? Maybe was there a moment or a special situation that turned everything in your life that you became an activist? What was it?
Well, it goes back 60 years. When I was 10 years old, I lived in an Eastern Canadian fishing village, and I spent an entire summer swimming with a family of beavers in the forest. And the next year when I went back, I couldn't find the beavers. I found out that trappers had taken them all during the winter. That made me very angry. So that winter I began to walk the trap lines and free the animals from the traps and destroy the traps. So I really began as an activist when I was just turned 11. And I've been doing the same thing ever since and in different ways. So there was no real thing that made me change. It's just what I've been doing all my life.
Nice. I mean, that's not so many times that people start already with 10 years to, I mean, and I know there are many, many kids nowadays, especially, which really, the kids have this connection to the nature so much more, to the animals, but then at some point, society pushes us into a system and then we lose this connection. And I think we really have to get back to this connection again, right? I
mean, all children have an intuitive understanding of nature and the world about us. What our educational systems does is take that intuition away and replace it with, regurgitated information, really. Back in 1975, I had the occasion to speak with a school in Prince Edward Island off of British Columbia. It was a Haida Indian reservation. And in the morning, we spoke to the kindergarten class. And I said, how many of you kids speak Haida, the language? And they all did. How many kids know anything about whales? Didn't have to say a thing, just listened to everything they knew about whales. They saw them every day. And so by the time I got to middle school, only half of them spoke the language and only half of them cared about whales. By the time I got to the seniors, no one spoke Haida and no one gave a damn about whales. So we'd taken these beautiful, intelligent, intuitive children and turned them into complete idiots by our educational system. And so that's when people ask, what should we teach our children? I always say, don't teach them anything, just listen to them. Ask them what they want, what they think, what their dreams are, and encourage their dreams, encourage their ideas. And I think it works. I did this experimentally with my own daughter. When she was 7 years old, I said, look, I'm not your boss. I'm not here to tell you what to do or who you're going to be or how to think. I'm just here to give you guidance. So you can be whatever you want. And don't ever let anybody deter you or tell you that they can't do that. And she's 40 years old now, but now I've got a son who's 4 and I'm doing the same thing with him.
Nice. Yeah, it's amazing. Well, it is so beautiful because in the end, like you said, the children are teaching us so much. We lost this deep connection on the way, but the children still have it. So they can be the biggest teacher for us if we really listen again. It's amazing. Thank you.
Well, you know, when I was a child, there's two things I did. One of them is I took a map of the world and cut it up and got in trouble for that. But I put all the continents together and I said to the teacher, you know, I think this is all one continent, and it all broke apart. And she said, well, that's stupid. That's a really stupid thing to say. And of course, I was right. Why was I right? Was I smarter than her? No, it just made sense to me as a child. It was logical. It made sense. Mm-hmm. And the other thing I said, you know, I don't think dinosaurs were really reptiles. And I think they were more like birds and probably had feathers. And she's all that stupid. So I think that we should, that's why I say we should listen to children, and not try to dictate our values and our realities to them. And I'm really happy that there's so many young people today who are actually speaking their mind and they're not being deterred. Greta Thunberg's a good example. I mean, she's not put off by world leaders telling her she doesn't know what she's talking about or anything. When people say, well, you know, what does she know? She's only a 16-year-old girl. I said, well, a little older now, but I said, what other adult do you know who has addressed the United Nations and speaks to world leaders about climate change and they actually listen? So, you know, give her credit for what she's done. She's done a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. Awesome. Hey, when I give a lot of speeches in schools too, so from kindergarten to the universities and even outside, and I can feel you can reach these kids, and the kids, they are so much into these topics because they love this world. They love the animals. And when they go home, they bring the topic home to their parents. So you even get the parents at the same time when you get the children, when they listen to you and when you can listen to them and work together. And this is really beautiful. Do you have, when I talk at my speeches, I see always that, yes, I bring some facts. I bring some scientific facts, background knowledge, but mostly what really catches the people, the people's heart especially, is emotion. So when I share my stories of what I faced when I saw the whales in front of me dying, when I was witnessing how the dolphins in Taiji get killed, or how the fish in a fishing net was caught and I freed him. And afterwards, when he was free, he came back and looked into my eyes and deep into my heart. That changed my life. When I share these stories, I see the change in people's eyes, that it's changing something in their hearts. Do you have one of these big stories from you to what you want to share with us? Something you really experienced, what touched you so deeply?
Well, there's been many, many experiences over the years, but I do believe a life-changing experience was way back in 1975. I was with Greenpeace at the time. We came up with this idea to protect whales by putting our bodies between the harpoons and whales. And we were reading a lot of Gandhi at the time, so we thought that this was going to work. So Robert Hunter and I found ourselves in a small little inflatable boat in front of a Soviet harpoon vessel that was bearing down on us at full speed. And in front of us were eight magnificent sperm whales that were fleeing for their life. And every time the harpooner tried to shoot, I would block the harpoon and with the boat. And this worked for about 20 minutes until the captain on the Soviet vessel came running down the catwalk, screamed into the ear of the harpooner, and then looked down on us, smiled, and brought his finger across his throat. And that's when I realized Gandhi's not going to work for us today. A few moments later, there was this horrendous explosion, and the harpoon went over our heads, slammed into the backside of a female in a pod of whales. It just narrowly missed her. And she screamed and rolled on her side in a pool of blood. And suddenly, the largest whale in that pod slapped the water with a thunderclap and dove, swam right underneath us, threw himself at the bow of the Soviet vessel, and to protect his own kind. And they were ready for him. They knew he would do this. And they fired a second harpoon unattached harpoon, hit the whale point blank in the head, and the whale fell back screaming in agony in the surface. And as he thrashed about on the surface, I caught his eye, and I saw him dive again and come swimming really fast underwater towards us. And he came up and out of the water at an angle so that the next move would to come down and crush us, fall down on top of us. And as his head rose up out of the water, and I looked into this eye, an eye the size of my fist, so close I could see my own reflection in that eye. I saw something that changed my life completely, and that was understanding. That the whale understood what we were trying to do, because I could see the effort he made to pull himself back. His head began to slide into the sea as I went beneath the surface, and he died. Could have killed us, chose not to do so. But I saw something else in that eye, pity. Not for himself, but for us, that we could take life so thoughtlessly, so callously. And what for? As I sat in the midst of the Soviet whaling fleet with the sun going down, I said to myself, why are they killing these whales? They don't eat sperm whales. They kill them for oil, spermaceti oil, highly prized for high heat-resistant lubricating oil. And one of the things at the time that it was very highly prized for was the manufacture of intercontinental ballistic missiles. And I said, here we are, killing this incredibly beautiful, intelligent, sentient, self-aware creature for the purpose of making a weapon meant for the mass extermination of human beings. And that's when it struck me. We're insane. We're ecologically, we're certainly insane. And from that moment on, I said, I don't do what I do for people. I do what I do for them. In the long run, it's gonna certainly help people, but I do what I do for them. So 10 years later, we sank half of Iceland's whaling fleet, destroyed their whale processing plant, shut them down for 17 years. And instead of getting praised by environmental groups, we were attacked. And a former colleague from Greenpeace came to me and he said, just want to let you know that what you did in Iceland was reprehensible, unforgivable, and you're an embarrassment to this movement. And I said, so? He said, well, aren't you concerned about what people think? I said, no, not at all. I don't really care what you think. We didn't sink those whaling ships for you or Greenpeace or anybody else. We sank them for the whales. Find me a whale that disagreed with what we did that day, and I won't do it again. But until then, we're going to continue sinking whaling ships when we can.
Yeah, exactly. There popped up so many questions now. This is a really big story. Thank you for sharing this. That's what my next question would have been as well. I mean, when you founded Sea Shepherd, you have been co-founder from Greenpeace as well. I mean, you have been on the board of director of Greenpeace as well, right? And you founded Sea Shepherd in 1977. So you changed the organization as well. I mean, you created your own organization to focus on the ocean especially as well, and to really act and make action. What, there were for sure many, many ways where the wind came and blew in your face, and you got a lot of shitstorm, I can imagine, within the last years, and maybe still today, of course, because there are a lot of people out there who don't want to hear what you are sharing, the message you share. What was your biggest, the hardest moment when you really faced, what was the hardest thing for you to face in this time of being with Sea Shepherd?
Well, nothing really. The strength of an ecosystem is in diversity, and diversity of ideas, diversity of approaches. And for Greenpeace, that's all well and good. They're a protest organization, but I'm not a protester. To me, it's too submissive. It's like, please, please don't kill the whales. And then all you do is hang banners and take pictures. So I set Sea Shepherd up to intervene, not to protest. And I set it up with a specific strategy, which I call aggressive nonviolence. We're not going to hurt anybody, but we're going to be aggressive. And we've shut down hundreds of illegal operations, poaching operations, without hurting anybody and without sustaining any injuries ourselves, which is an incredible record after 40 years, 42 years. And that's just our approach. It's a different one. It's an interventionist thing. Now, when I say diversity, it doesn't matter if you're involved in the movement, the ecology movement, well, any movement. The approaches can be litigation or legislation or direct action or education. It doesn't really matter as long as it's all pointing towards the same objective. So I don't expect people to do what I do. I'm not going to do what everybody else does. We just have to find where we belong. And that is recognizing your abilities, your talents, and putting them to service by harnessing your passion to imagination and courage to make a difference.
Yeah. And you were explaining before about the whales as well, when you said that you felt this animal, this living being, when you watched in the whale's eye. I mean, if you look at the animals, there is no way that we don't really recognize these animals as living beings. But maybe some people still do not see that, right? But when you talk about whales, some people might not understand why is it so important to save whales. I mean, why whales? What are whales doing for the ocean, for us? Why is it so important?
Well, I think it's important to say diversity, but specifically whales. Whales are the farmers of the oceans. When you reduce whale populations, you reduce phytoplankton populations. Whales provide the nutrients in the form of nitrogen and iron in their feces. Consider one blue whale every day defecates 3 tons of nutrients into the water. They are the farmers of the ocean. Of course, other animals also included, sea mammals, seabirds, fish, also provide those nutrients. Nature takes care of itself in that way. But I believe that especially with whales and dolphins, we're dealing with a very intelligent life form that I believe we will one day, if we become smart enough, that we'll be able to communicate with them. And using computers to try and break into their language and that. And we're always finding discoveries, you know. I mean, there's so much to discover. I mean, Sea Shepherd discovered a new species of whale in November of last year. And last week, there was a discovery that they found out that sperm whales were actually warning other sperm whales of the operations of whaling fleets back in the 19th century. And, you know, if anybody's taken biology 101, you know, I remember the teacher puts up a model of a rat's brain, and then a dog brain, then a chimpanzee brain, then the human brain. And they'll say, well, you can see by the increasing size of the brain and the more complex the convolutions on the neocortex area are, that the dog is more intelligent than the rat, the chimpanzee more intelligent than the dog, and humans more intelligent than the chimpanzee. But they never, ever put an orca or sperm whale brain out there. It makes us look really, really stupid. The human brain is 1,700 cubic centimeters on average. Compare that to the orca brain of 6,000 cubic centimeters and the sperm whale brain, the largest brain we've ever developed, at 9,000 cubic centimeters. And marine mammals have four lobes to the brain as compared to all other mammals. And that fourth lobe is almost all completely involved with associative behavior, communications, things like that. But and the convolution areas on the neocortex are far, far, far more pronounced. These are extremely intelligent beings. And people say, well, they're big animals, they got big brains. Well, you know, dinosaurs are big animals and had small brains. It just doesn't compute. And if you were to measure brain to body size for intelligence, well, the hummingbird will beat us all out.
Yes, that's true. It's interesting to have these facts to balance, to see this once. Imagine it, right? It makes a lot of sense.
Well, see, we measure intelligence by hand-eye coordination, the ability to manufacture tools. If a blob of protoplasm stepped out of a spaceship from Oro, we'd say, oh, it must be an intelligent species from an intelligent planet. It's got technology. I was debating a Norwegian whaler one time. He said, well, Watson, you'll say that whales are more intelligent than people. This is a stupid thing to say. How can you say something so stupid? And I said, well, George, I measure intelligence by the ability to live in harmony with the natural world. By that criteria, whales are far more intelligent than we are. And he looked at me and said, oh, by that criteria, cockroaches are more intelligent than we are. I said, George, you're beginning to understand what I'm trying to tell you.
Yeah, really. I mean, if we are destroying our own home, I cannot see another species who's doing that. But
we're not successful, really. Humans are not successful. There's only one surviving hominid on this planet. Look how many species of dolphins are, 700,000 species of beetles. How many species of sea urchins? I mean, we are the last surviving hominid. We haven't done a very good job of it. The Homo neanderthalus, you know, we helped wipe them out, you know. So can you imagine the world today with all the ridiculous problems we have with racism today? Can you imagine a world with two species of humans, Homo neanderthals and us? Neanderthals actually had bigger brains than we did. And they were certainly four times stronger. I mean, every single football team in the world would be composed of just Neanderthals. You know, of course, everybody would hate them because of that. So, you know, we've just not been very successful as an so-called intelligent species.
Yeah.
I always describe us as a bunch of overly conceited naked apes who've become divine legends in our own mind.
Great. Hey, people call sea shepherd as well pirates. What does piracy mean for you? I mean, how do you explain this?
Well, you know, back in the 90s, our opposition would call us pirates. And I said, you know, if you want to call us pirates, we'll be pirates. What the hell? You know, the kids like it. It's very romantic and everything. And there's a lot of lessons to be learned from about pirates, you know, because people don't really understand the history of piracy. In a world where a 10-year-old boy could be hung in London for stealing a loaf of bread, was it a far stretch to go to sea and, you know, try to get rich by being a pirate? I mean, there's no difference between the penalty. Anne Bonny, one of the most famous women pirates, when she said, well, you know, it's a death penalty for piracy. And she said, well, thank God for that, too. If it wasn't for the death penalty, every idiot would be doing this. Okay. But let's take a look at what piracy was. It was independence and freedom. The pirates of the 17th century elected their captains. And they didn't, you know, nobody was flogged. They elected their officers. Anybody, regardless of race or gender, could become a pirate and participate. Blackbeard used to attack slave ships, free the slaves, and give them a choice. You can go ashore, you can join my crew. And if you join my crew, you can rise to the level of your confidence. There were officers, pirate officers, there was black officers, captains, you know, and they're way ahead of their time at that. And people say, oh, they're a bunch of thieves. Yes, they were. They stole gold from Spanish galleons. And where did that gold come from? They stole it from the Indians. So is it really ever a thief? It's sort of like Robin Hood robbing from the rich and giving to the poor, really. So I think that piracy has got a raw deal. The real pirates, by the way, not many people realize of the history that Captain Nelson, later the famous Horatio Nelson, the Admiral, he was sent to the Caribbean to control piracy. He couldn't get his ship out of port because of lawsuits brought against him by merchants, British merchants, who were on the take.
not much different than the way things are today. So how was piracy ended, say, in Panama? Henry Morgan did it, a pirate. And he became a real pirate then when they made him governor of Jamaica for doing it. But the thing is that, and today, what do we have today? The pirates of Somalia, those horrible pirates off of the Gulf of Guinea. Who are they? They're impoverished fishermen who've been put out of work by the real pirates, the Asian and European fishing fleets that have come down and plundered their waters. The average Somali pirate is nothing more than a poor fisherman who is trying to survive. And meanwhile, those gigantic super trawlers and purse seiners and huge corporate fleets are just plundering everything in African waters, and they get a pass, you know. Yeah. So it's really a world of rampant hypocrisy.
Yes, completely. I mean, I see so many times that people are talking about, yeah, these fishermen there somewhere in Indonesia, they are killing sharks and they're bad people and whatever. But in the end, these fishermen are forced to catch sharks because there's nothing left what they can catch. And they are trying to save their family sometimes, right? And they have nothing to survive. Where the real problem is coming from is our supermarket. We are buying every day. We want to have fish all the time. We don't see the big picture and don't understand that we are plundering the ocean, where people are forced to find something in the ocean to survive.
The lobbyists and the PR people for the corporate fishing industry, they have this way of, they're going to distract us by saying, every time we oppose them, they come and say, what about the poor fisherman? He's out there making a living, you know, in his little boat. That is not the reality. In fact, the corporate fishing operations are the biggest threat to artisanal fishing operations in Africa or India or anywhere else. They're the ones who are taking the fish away from them. You know, but they want to make it look like we're the ones that are going into little African villages and say, don't catch the fish. Mm-hmm. You know, in fact, the reality is Sea Shepherd is in partnership with African nations to protect the fisheries from those huge foreign corporate operations. The fishing industry worldwide operates only because it receives massive government subsidies, about $76 billion a year, provided by the EU, by the US, by all these other countries. Fishing as a corporate entity could not survive on its own. It just simply cannot, because the oceans are overfished. The diversity has been diminished to an extreme point, and that means they have to spend more and more money to catch less and less. These ships that have cost $100 million, that takes a lot of bank loans and a lot of fish to be caught to pay off those bank loans. Then there's the other thing, which I call the economics of extinction. As populations diminish, the value of those fish now become higher, motivating more and more demand, and therefore motivating more people to go out and catch more and more and more. Bluefin tuna is a good example. It's been about pretty much 97% removed from the sea. Now, there is Mitsubishi alone, this one company, Mitsubishi, they have 10 to 15 year supply of bluefin tuna in their warehouses frozen. They could provide their market with bluefin tuna for the next decade without having to catch another fish. But the reason they won't do that is because the bluefin tuna is the most expensive fish on the planet right now. And if they stop doing it, and let's say the numbers begin to rise in the sea, that means that the value of the fish in the warehouses will now decline, because scarcity translates into higher prices, and demand, of course, does the same thing. So, and what happens if they go extinct? Mitsubishi doesn't care. They're not in the fishing industry. That's just short-term investment, short-term gain. They'll just take the profits and put it into computers or cars or whatever else they're doing. The reality is that there are no real commercial fishing people today. There's the illusion that there is. And also, the fishing industry has this incredible hold over politicians. I actually coined a word for it called homopeshophobia, which means the politician's fear of fishermen, that the fishermen, whatever the fishermen want, the fishermen get, because of somehow or other, they, like farmers, are these sacred, it's a sacred industry, and you better not mess with us because we're providing you with fish, we're providing you with wheat and rice and whatever, so you give us what we want. And I've seen so many times governments capitulate. For instance, we were in the Galapagos when they were upset because the government put restrictions on sea cucumber exploitation. And so the fishermen rioted. They kidnapped turtles and held them hostages. They kidnapped some of my crew and held them hostages. And they attacked the ranger station in the Galapagos and threatened to burn it down. And instead of responding with law enforcement, the government gave them what they wanted. Yeah. And I got called in by the Navy captain. He says, you know, you got to get your people out of the park. I said, they're taking over. He said, it doesn't matter. He says, you can't do that. I mean, you know, because, you know, the fishermen have said, I said, you're taking your orders from the fishermen?
Yeah, that's crazy. That's kind of crazy. Why do you think is this? Why do you think is this that the politicians, for example, don't have the guts? Can I say that? I mean, don't do something. I mean, do you think the big change is coming from politicians? Because many people ask me always. But when I give tips on what we can do to change something, right? And I speak about many topics, not just ocean conservation, about plastic pollution, animal rights in general, veganism. And then people say, but the big choice and the big change has to come from the politicians. Well, if we wait for that, then we wait for a long time.
Politicians have never changed anything in history. The anti-slavery movement was not, Abraham Lincoln did not free the slaves. That's a myth. Anti-slavery movement was got off the ground and was championed by people like Wilberforce and Douglas and others. Abraham Lincoln, during the war, actually said that if I can end this war by freeing the slaves, I will do it. If I can end it by not freeing the slaves, I will do it, but I will end the war. And he ended slavery as a strategy against the South. And then he turned around and sent 40,000 Black people to Africa after this. You know, that's where the nation of Liberia was founded by freed American slaves. So, you know, it was all phony. And women getting the vote in the United States and other countries, but in the United States, they were beaten, they were jailed, and they were harassed. And one of the guys who was leading this harassment was Woodrow Wilson, the president of the United States. In 1920, when they signed the amendment to give women the vote, who signed it and who got credit for it? Woodrow Wilson, the man who was the main antagonist. We don't remember all the women who suffered. We remember Woodrow Wilson for doing this. Politicians take credit for what people do. People change things. Politicians don't. And for better or worse, they do. People enable the bad ones, and they don't really encourage the good ones, really, you know. So politics is, so as they always describe it, it's the art of the possible. Now, if you expect a politician to actually make a decision to actually change things, well, that's a little too risky. For instance, I remember 30 years ago in Canada, the Prime Minister of Canada there, a conservative Prime Minister, Joe Clark, he said, you know, we really should pay the amount of the value for a gallon of gasoline for what it really is. You know, this is all subsidized. It's removed the subsidies and people should pay so they understand exactly what the value is. 6 months later, he was no longer prime minister.
That's the thing, right? Politicians, there are some, I know some quite good as well in my country. And as soon as they are in the politics, they are, even if they want to change, they are facing this wind as well, and it's hard for them to do something because there's so much wind against them. When they can get out of it, I know some which left politics, they did all they wanted to do, and then they were able to really act on what they wanted to do.
Nicolas Hulot, who was environment minister for France, you know, he became environment minister, and I know him personally. He legitimately wanted to do, you know, positive things. He resigned. He said, I can't do anything.
Yeah.
My hands are tied at every opportunity. The Minister of Finance, the Minister of Fisheries, the Minister of Industry all have precedence over me. Mm-hmm. What they want, they get. And so he said, I'm just wasting my time here. You know,
yeah.
And I've seen that in many other cases now. There are good, in the United States, we have good politicians. There's Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, there's Bernie Sanders and everything like this. But, you know, they're always put aside, saying, oh, these people are socialists, whatever that means, or we can't vote them. They're going to just take our guns away or something like this. I mean, you know, strangely enough, it was John Adams, the second president of the United States, who said, you know, who gave us a warning about this. If you ever allow the majority of people to have exactly what they want, you're not going to like what that is. Because if that is the case, we're going to have abortions, banning abortions completely, 100% for any reason. We're going to have the death penalty. We're going to have all of these things because, you know, this is what everybody is wired up to do. Mob mentality, basically, what it comes down to. And what politicians are really good at, however, is pitting one group of people against another group of people, the rich against the poor, the blacks against whites, blah, blah, blah. You know, this is what they're really good at, really good at doing.
Yeah. Maybe we should take this this thing they can do good and convert it somehow to exactly reach the goals we need to reach. Maybe there is a way to convert it.
And there is no black and white when it really comes to. I know a lot of really rich people who are doing a lot of really good things. Yeah. And I know a lot of rich people are doing a lot of bad things. And I know a lot of poor people are doing a lot of bad things and a lot of poor people do good. So you really can't say, okay, everybody's rich is bad and everybody's, you know, is that kind of thing. You know, and the same with, I know a lot of white people are doing great things and a lot that are doing bad things. I know black people are doing bad things, but you know, it's this is a problem. We're constantly dividing, you know, humanity into these little groups of this group is good, this group is bad. And it's a form of tribalism in a way. You know, it's, I once wrote an essay called 7 billion monkeys on a spinning ball of mud. And I said, and these monkeys are obsessed with balls. They don't care. They're throwing them through hoops, kicking them down the thing, you know, throwing, you know, do balls, 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 everything. They go nuts over balls, you know, and everything. And, you know, I just find it amazing. If people really put as much passion into protecting the environment or into loving nature as they do with knocking a ball down a golf course or throwing it through a hoop, I think that we would be much further off. And again, it's also, actually, I had an amazing experience one time. There was a restaurant many years ago. There's a restaurant in the United States called Medieval Times. Mm-hmm. And you go there and you get your medieval meal and you get to watch knights jousting and doing all these things. But they sit, you don't have any choice where you sit. So you're in the green section, the blue section, the red section, whatever. Your knight is the green knight, the blue knight, or the red knight. You got to cheer for your knight. You don't have any choice. You cheer for your knight because that's the section you're in. Well, within 10 minutes, everybody in the red section hates everybody in the blue section. Everybody in the blue section hates everybody in the green section. The only reason they're there is by chance. You know? And that really what it comes down to nationalities. We don't have any choice what country we're born in, you know, or what religion we're born into and everything. But that's what we're born in. That's got to be the truth because that's where that's what we are, you know. I had said to my sister one time because I took her to Europe for when she graduated from high school, and we're sitting there in Italy actually, and she said, "Oh, this is awful." I said, "What? Look at all those flags. I mean, there's no Canadian flag here." I said, "Well, you know, this is Italy. Those are all like
Italian. I've done no Canada so much."
Yeah, these are all Italian provincial flags or whatever. And she said, "Well, I don't know about you, but I'm proud to be a Canadian." I said, "What does that mean?"
Yes,
you were born 30 miles north of the United States border. If you had been born 31 miles south, you'd be, "I'm proud to be an American," you know.
What does it mean?
It doesn't mean anything, really, you know. When people ask, I say, I have Canadian citizenship, I have U.S. citizen, but it doesn't mean anything to me. I look at more of myself as a North American, but more importantly, an Earthling, really.
I just wanted to say that when people ask me where I'm from, because many people don't understand my slang, my English version of talking, where it might come from. Well, I live in Italy. I was born in Italy. It's the northern part. We normally speak German. So it was part of Austria before. Now it's part of Italy. We still have people who don't really like to speak Italian and the opposite. And I think, well, I think it's a privilege if I grew up with different languages and with different cultures, and if I can learn more of this world, and if I learn different languages and people, and I am from this world, I don't care where you're from. It's nice to know, how did you grow up? Okay, we can talk about the culture, right? It's interesting because we are always, all of us, a bit raised different, but in the end, we are all one. We are all one species. We are all trying to, we want to have a happy life, but if we don't care for this world, if we don't care for the future, then we won't have that for our children, because we have to change, to choose now. And I think the choice where we are born, like you said, so interesting, we don't have the choice where we are born. Maybe some people might say, yeah, your soul chooses before you come. Okay, maybe we can talk about this, but in the end, we don't, right now, I cannot choose, right? I'm Italian. But what I can choose is what I want to do right now, what I want to change in my world right now to create a world that is beautiful, not just for me, but for my friends, for my family, and for the future generations as well, and for the animals, and for all of us. That's what I can choose. This is in my responsibility, in my choice, and my, now I can do that.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Yeah, and that's beautiful. I think it's beautiful that we have the choice. in this moment.
Yeah, but a lot of people think they don't have a choice, and that's a problem.
Yeah, that's the same. Like, I wanted to ask you this too. So many people told me or asked me at the beginning when I started to become an activist. Later, now it changed a little bit because the people started to see what I have done, what I achieved, how many speeches I gave, how many people are coming and writing something about it. So the people see it, there is change happening. But at the beginning, many people said, well, you alone can't make a difference. When you, just because you stop using plastic, just because you pick up, because you do not eat fish anymore. Do you think that changed anything? No. And I was really like, I was happy and really, it was good for me that I was growing up already always as a small rebel in me, right? So as a child, I was a rebel and this was really good in this moment for me. So I did not care that the people said that. But it can take a lot of energy from people who are maybe not having such a rebel inside and who listen too much to other people. So maybe they are not... They believe in these people because they all, everybody says you can't change anything. What do you tell the people if they say that to you?
Way back in the early 80s, I got a phone call from a guy in Scotland. He said, they're killing gray seals up here in the Orkney Islands. What are you going to do about it? And I said, I don't know. I'm on the other side of the planet. What are you going to do about it? He said, well, what can I do? Well, I said, you live in Scotland. That's one advantage you have. And anyway, we helped him to put together a Sea Shepherd group in Scotland. And he and a bunch of volunteers went up to the Orkney Islands. Very enthusiastic bunch. They walked up to the sealers, literally pulled the rifles out of their hands and threw them into the ocean. And they all got arrested. And they all went on trial. And we all got off and got acquitted. But we got so much publicity that we raised the money to buy that island, which is now a seal sanctuary. And all because one guy said, well, what can I do? One of my crew members, he was 18 years old, he wanted to say, we got to do something about the treatment of laboratory animals and, you know, how cruel they're being treated. And I said, well, you know, Alex, Sea Shepherd's not going to get involved with that. But if you're passionate about it, why don't you do something about it? He said, well, what can I do? I said, well, use your imagination. Come up with, you know, I'm sure you can come up with some strategy. So he went back to the U.S. and he got a job in one of those laboratories and spent a year documenting everything. And then he went to to Maryland, got a job there. And then he went to the Washington Post and to the TV stations. And he said, and exposed them for what they did and shut them down. But then he set up a group called the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. He was the founder of the People for or PETA. And that's because, you know, one person can make a difference that way. Because of Diane Fossey, mountain gorillas have survived in Rwanda. Because of David Wingate, the Bermuda storm petrel in Bermuda did not go extinct. There are so many examples of how one person can make a difference.
Yes, totally, totally. And I mean, as well, Sea Shepherd started with you. I mean... Everyone I know, like even people I interview for my movie, I'm creating a movie on hope. And the people I interview for that, there are some people which created a big organization, but some they all started small. And some people, they did not want to create something big. They wanted to do something where they are, right here, and just act every single day. This is the change we need. But every person can do something. You don't have to create an organization. You don't have to be a marine biologist to save the ocean. Just start maybe to not eat fish. That's already a good start, maybe. Sea Shepherd is supporting veganism. Can you say something a little bit about that or why? I mean...
Well, in 1979, all our ships became vegetarian vessels. And then 20 years later, they became vegan vessels. And now you don't have to be vegan or vegetarian to join the crew, but you have to be vegan to be on the crew because that's all you're going to have to eat. What we wanted to do is to set an example to show that, first of all, you know, you can survive on a vegan diet. It actually has a lot of advantages, especially with ships. You know, you don't have to go through all those silly quarantine regulations and everything else like that. So it's very helpful. But also, how can you tell people to not, you know, to not eat fish when if you don't respect that yourself? And even when you're eating meat, you eat fish because, you know, a good 35% of all of the fish caught is fed to animals like pigs and chickens and such and such. I mean, it's a world out of balance where chickens are eating more fish than all the world's albatrosses and puffins and pigs are eating more fish than sharks. So we do that to set an example. I think we're completely hypocritical. I remember we were in Cape Town, South Africa, with our vessel, the Steve Irwin, and the Greenpeace vessel, I think it was the Esperanza, was there. And some of our crew went over to visit the Greenpeace boat. And they, all the crew were having on the Greenpeace boat were having dinner and they were eating fish, but they're in the middle of a campaign to protect fish. Mm-hmm. And our cook who was there, she was an Australian woman. She said, well, how can you be saving fish and, you know, doing this? And their cook said, oh, well, you know, we just got to be practical and everything. And people have to eat. And our cook said, well, our ships are all vegan. And that their cook said, oh, That's just stupid.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. Well, telling people you should eat. I see that with many organizations, they say that people, you should eat more sustainable fish to save the ocean. I mean,
There is no sustainable fishery. I mean, again, it's not black and white. There are sustainable fisheries. If you go out in your little canoe off of the coast of Gabon and catch a fish, then that would be a sustainable fishery. But when you go into a restaurant in Paris or Rome or New York City and order Chilean sea bass, that's a fish called Antarctic or Patagonia toothfish caught in the coast of Antarctica and transported halfway around the world to go to some restaurant. That is not a sustainable fishery. In fact, you couldn't, and it's all a marketing thing too, because Chilean sea bass is not from Chile and it's not a bass, but toothfish doesn't sound as appetizing. So that's why they marketed it as that name. So there's so much fraud going on in this thing. We're dealing with a multi-billion dollar a year industry that is heavily subsidized to the tune of $76 billion a year from governments. This is a big opposition. And, you know, we just did this film, Seaspiracy, and the fishing industry is up in arms on it. And they got their PR companies working full time, but we don't care. Yeah. We don't care what they say. Here's the latest thing. Well, you know, the film's pretty inaccurate. It says there's a study that's proved to be false that the fish will be gone by 2048. A new study was put out and found out that was only 88% production. It's not going to be gone. So in other words, it could be 2048. It could be 2078. It could be 2030. We don't know. But these guys, this is what they're arguing about, is that, well, that's a flawed paper or something like this.
Because they don't have arguments, right? I mean, there is no argument for going on with what we do. It's no argument. I have 2-3 more questions. Do you have still a little bit of time or do you have to go?
No, this is fine. Yeah.
Okay, cool. Because I hear your phone in the background. So I think you're quite busy. I know that. I mean, how can people support Sea Shepherd? What is the best way to do? Can they go on a ship? I mean, I am volunteer. I know how it works, but can you explain what is the best to do to support the whole
ship? There's 3 ways of supporting Sea Shepherd. One, you can volunteer to crew on the ships. And right now, I think we have about 250 volunteers from about 25 different countries on those ships. There's about 12 ships now, I think. Or people can be shore volunteers, which means working to support the ships while on shore, everything from fundraising to getting supplies, or also participating in cleaning up plastic debris at their local beaches and areas. And the third is by just becoming a supporting member, because these ships are extremely expensive. So any help, financial help we can get is really, you know, certainly helpful. But the one thing that's different between Sea Shepherd and a lot of groups is that we don't spend money to raise money. We don't do direct mail appeals. We're not on the corners asking for money. We're not paying for advertisements. People come to us. We don't go to them. And we feel that if people really want to protect the ocean and to ensure the future, that they will come to us on that. Yeah. And that what it means is we have an extremely loyal support base, you know, because we don't have to beg them for funds.
Yeah. And at the same time, you have very loyal volunteers. I mean, many people are volunteering, which is, I was volunteering because it comes from my heart. It's my passion. And that's what you once said. It's not possible to pay professionals to do what volunteers are doing with their passion, right? This is beautiful as well, I think.
Well, one of the criticisms that we've had over the years is that, you know, we have volunteer crews, and, you know, it was, even though we've not lost anybody, but I was inspired by an editorial in the London Times in 1911 that criticized Ernest Shackleton because his crew were a bunch of volunteers and amateurs, and they weren't professionals. And what Shackleton said at the time was, I don't want professionals. I need people with the passion to get me where I need to go. And I'm not going to get that from professionals. No. You can't pay people to do what volunteers do for nothing, the hours they put in, the risks they take. Another criticism we get is that you're asking people to risk your life, because I have said, well, if you want to join the crew, I do ask this question, are you willing to risk your life to protect a whale? And if they say no, well, we're not we don't want you. They said, well, how can you ask people to risk their life? That's just unethical. I said, well, you know, we ask young people to risk their life, not only risk their life, to give their life, to take life, to protect oil wells, real estate, religion, and flags. I think it's a far more noble pursuit to ask somebody to risk their life to protect an endangered species or a threatened ecosystem.
Yeah, yeah, totally. I mean, when I was in the Faroe Islands, I saw that, I felt that as well, that I knew why I put myself between the whales and the whalers. This was for the whales, this was for the cause, and I did it with all of my heart. And if there was a guy pointing a gun on us, but if he would have shot, he would have shot, that's it. But I knew exactly why I was there. And this was so much bigger for me than anything else. So the question was very easy to answer for me. But yeah, it's good that you make this clear for the people before they come on board as well. That's really, really good for them to know as well, so they can really think about, am I ready to do this, right? This is important to think about too.
Yeah, it's also in the telephone. For instance, 1981, we were the first group to invade the Soviet Union since World War II, when we landed in Siberia to give evidence on illegal whaling operations. And, you know, I went in there with my crew, and we had a confrontation with the Soviet military, and we actually survived. But during that confrontation, I had some of my crew were going hysterical, you know, about we got to surrender to them. I said, before we came here, I sat you all down and told you exactly what the risks were. Mm-hmm. And now you're freaking out about what we're doing. Well, we didn't, you know, really think you were, well, I said, that's a problem. You didn't think, but we're taking these risks for a reason. And I said, if you don't think the risks are acceptable, you shouldn't be involved in this. But courage is its own reward. You know, you know. For instance, when I hunted down and rammed the pirate whaler Sierra in 1979, I chased this ship into a Portuguese port, and I could have hit it at sea, but that would have been putting too many people's lives in danger. I had to control the situation. So I put the ship alongside, and I gave my crew, there were 20 of us on board, I said, look, I'm going to go out and I'm going to ram that ship. I'm going to disable it permanently. And I can't say you won't get hurt, but I will guarantee you, you're going to go to jail if we do this. And I said, but I'm not going to force anybody to do what they don't want. So you got 10 minutes to pack your stuff and get off the ship, because we're leaving in 10 minutes. 10 minutes later, 17 of them were off the ship. There was me and two engineers. That was all that was left. And we went out and we rammed that ship, and we got in a big pile of chase by the Portuguese Navy, and we got brought back, and I was hauled before the port captain, and I was charged with gross criminal negligence. And I looked at the port captain and I said, well, there wasn't anything negligent about this. We rammed that ship exactly where we intended to hit it. It wasn't negligent. It was deliberate. And the captain looked at me and he smiled. He says, well, yeah, but the other problem is I don't know who owns that ship. And until I know, well, you're free to go. So I walked out the door. Well, one of the crew who got off, he said, well, what, they let you go? I said, yeah. He said, well, if I knew you're going to get away with it, I would have been there too. I said, that's the thing. Sometimes you have to go into these situations knowing that you probably won't get away with it.
Yeah.
But the risks are worth taking. If you really are sincere about what you want to do, then the risks are worth taking.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, you have a small son. He's Tiger is his name, right? Real little cute guy. When you post a picture, it's really nice to see. And I can see that you really raise him to a very responsible human being. And this is so beautiful to see. I mean, we have to maybe share this more for other parents. Do you have a tip for other parents what they should share with their children? I mean, it's compassion what we have to pass on.
Yeah, I think you best by setting an example. Setting an example of how you behave towards animals, what you eat, that kind of thing. But more importantly, guiding through encouragement, and not through, you're going to have to do this, you're going to have to do that. And I think that those kind of lessons are worthwhile. Again, with my daughter, I told her she could do whatever she wanted. And later she got a job. She actually designs video games of all things. So I don't know if you know the game Halo.
I'm not a gamer. I don't know so much.
Anyway, she designed that. She's a producer on that. And anyway, when she went to get the job, her husband said, oh, Lanny, you don't have the experience. They're not going to give you the job. Why would they give you the job? You know, she says, well, all they're going to do is say no.
Yeah.
You know, what have I got to lose? Well, she went in, she got the job. So what I tell people is don't be put off by people telling you can't do something. Just you do it. And, you know, and it's remarkable what you can, you know, what you can achieve in that way. The other advice I gave to my daughter, which she took to heart and when she was 17, I said, look, Lanny, I'm not going to talk to you as your father. I'm going to talk to you as a man who was once a boy of 17. Don't believe a damn thing we say. We're full of crap. and you know, we will say anything and everything. And try and hold off getting married till you're at least 30, because any guy under 30 is just full of shit. So she held off. She got married at 29. So she, but I also said, never let a man control your life. You know, you should be in charge of your destiny. And if just walk away, just walk away. There's plenty of guys out there. Just walk away, you know, and it served her well, I think so.
Yes, I think so too. Well, that's as well one of the questions I wanted to ask. I have two more questions. So what is your biggest message you want to share right now? And that was already quite a good message for some people, for especially for girls, right? But what is your biggest message? If you want to say it in 2-3 sentences, the biggest thing you want to share with us.
I think that if I give any advice to anybody, it's just live your passion, you know, follow what your dreams, what you want to do, and never be deterred by anyone that you can't do what you set your mind to do.
And my last question for you, and then I let you go because you have lots to do. Do you have hope for the future? I mean, do you have hope for Little Tiger, for example? And did you see positive change in activism and in general in the last years?
Back in 1973, way, way back in 1973, I volunteered as a medic for the American Indian Movement during the occupation of Wounded Knee in South Dakota. And we were surrounded by 3,000 U.S. federal agents who were shooting at us, 20,000 rounds a night. They killed 2 people. They wounded 46. I went to Russell Means, who was the leader of the American Indian Movement. And I said, look, Russell, we can't win. The odds are against us. They're overwhelming. There's no way we can win. So why are we here? And he looked at me and he told me something I'll never forget. We're not concerned about the odds against us, not concerned about winning or losing. We're here because this is the right thing to do, the right time to do it, and the right place to be. Don't worry about the future. Concentrate and focus on the present. What we do in the present will define the future. So I don't get pessimistic because I don't worry about the future. All energies have to go into the present, and that will define the future. What we do today will determine what kind of world this will be 100 years from now, 10,000 years from now, 1 million years from now. That will have all those ripples that will go forward into the future. But we can't do anything about that. What we can do is control the ripples that we make each and every single day. So I've never been pessimistic anytime in my life. And also, I believe that the solution is to a seemingly impossible problem. The solution is to find the impossible answer. And that can be done. 1972, the very idea that Nelson Mandela would become president of South Africa was unthinkable. It was impossible. And yet the impossibility became possible. And I've seen so many examples of how the impossible has become possible. You know, the world that we live in now is many of the things in our world today would have been impossible 100 years ago, 200 years ago, 1,000 years ago. Impossible not only to, impossible to conceive even, to even understand. And yet all of these impossibilities become possible. And they become possible by the application of our courage and our imagination and the passion to pursue that course. So I guess I would say I'm more than optimistic, really. I don't know what the future is for my son, but I do know it's challenging for this reason. The world that I was raised in, probably we enjoyed the most of any time in human history, before and since, we enjoyed a world of more material wealth and more freedom than has ever been experienced or will ever be experienced. I was born into a world of 3 billion people. It's now almost 8 billion people. That means restrictions on freedoms and restrictions on material wealth to so many people. And I regret that those things that we enjoyed will not be something that future generations will see again. And I mean, even the tactics, the things that I was able to do in the 70s and 80s, couldn't even dream of doing today. I blockaded St. John's Harbor, Newfoundland, and kept an entire Canadian sealing fleet from leaving port for 2 weeks. If I did that today, they'd blow me up. They would dismiss me as a terrorist and deal with me in that way. So you constantly have to evolve. So today, Sea Shepherd doesn't do those kind of things, but we're still active. What we decided to do now is we partner with governments. We're now in partnership with governments in Africa and in Latin America. We provide the resources, the volunteers, they provide the authority and the enforcement, and that's making an impact. I think we've arrested 65 poaching vessels in African waters over the last year and a half. We're actually very much involved in Italy too, working with the police in Sicily to oppose poachers there. And one of the things that shows just how effective we become is the people that we're attracting. One of our captains is a former chief of staff of the Italian Navy, an admiral, and he's captaining one of our ships. So, you know, we're really attracting a lot of people who want to make a difference and are putting their skills towards that purpose. So I'm quite happy to see that we're going there. But you can never remain stagnant. What I mean is you all constantly have to evolve your tactics, evolve your strategies.
Yeah. Well, yeah, of course, we have to evolve. Like the world is changing, we have to change with it. And if we can change with it together, that's the way to go, not against it.
Right.
Well, Paul, thank you. Thank you so incredibly much for your time and for all the information and everything you shared with us. This is really incredible. And I thank you from the whole community, the Summer's Planet community, from deep in my heart. And I wish you all the best for everything you do, because it's just amazing, such a big cause. And well, yeah, I can't say more than thank you so, so, so much. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Thank you. Bye for now.
Bye, Paul.